Good morning, everybody. Please welcome Grönte, who has the ambitious goal to talk about the philosophy of hacking within half an hour. So I don't know whether there'll be time left for Q&A, but there will be a session afterwards also on that subject. So please welcome Grönte.
Yeah, thank you all for being here. It's good to see a keen interest in philosophy, especially on the early afternoon after last night's noisy party. As you mentioned, we only have half an hour, so I'm going to run quite short on time. So there might not be time for questions, but there's a discussion scheduled 50 minutes after the end of the talk at the Neusche Square. That said, let's get started. So, hacking. What I'm interested in is not so much a definition of hacking, but more the essence of hacking. What makes hacking different from, say, engineering? But to start at that, it's interesting to have a look at its definition, because there really isn't a coherent definition. I'm sure you're all aware of the debates, flame wars on hackers, crackers, blah, 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 blah. Personally, I find them incredibly dull. But it goes to show that it is not one uniform thing. It is a, as it says there, it's rooted in a community of communities in different subcultures, individuals and scenes that all share a specific relation towards technology. So that begs the questions of what is technology exactly then, and what is this hacking approach towards technology? So we'll start with technology. Technology somewhat suffers the same fate as hacking in not having a concise definition. However, it's been around for some 2,000-3,000 years, so there has been more of a consensus of what it actually means. And the two most common definitions I could find was the practical application of knowledge or science and the making or using of tools or systems to accomplish a specific task. And out of those two definitions, we can deduct three aspects, being it is based on human knowledge, it involves creation, and it is a means to an end. Now I'm quite sure that I don't have to explain to you that technology has some very problematic aspects. The half of this Congress has been about what the problematic aspects of technology, but it makes it clear that we need a critical examination. And over the last century, there have been lots of critiques on technology. Unfortunately, a lot were really bitter and reject technology altogether, which I don't really believe in going back to the Stone Age, but the in particular, Heidegger in the Die Frage nach Technik, or the question concerning technology, and lots of the work from the Frankfurter Schule have had a more interesting critical examination of technology that doesn't negate it altogether. And I would like to talk you through a blend of those technologies and try to see how it applies to our contemporary setting. Following Heidegger, we will go back 2,000 years to see how the ancient Greeks regarded technology, to give a bit of a historical perspective as to see how we have reached the point where we are at now. And you see these three aspects. To see how they link together, we'll start with it is a means to an end. That implies there is causality. Aristotle explained causality according to four different modes: the material mode, the material cause, the formal cause, the final cause, and the efficient cause. The material is just what it's actually made of. The form is its shape. And particularly interesting is the telic, the causa finalis, the telic end. The ancient Greeks believed that substances had an inherent orientation towards a certain end embedded inside them, which makes their understanding of the world quite different from how we regard it nowadays. And the causal efficiency is that what brings about the effect that is quite close to how we regard causality nowadays. It's, yeah, the usually in the case of technology, it's the actor that actually does something which puts the whole thing in motion. And these four causes altogether are responsible for something else. They are the cause altogether. They let what is not yet present arrive into presencing. Something was not there before, and now it is. And about this presencing, there's a nice quote from Plato here. Every occasion for whatever passes over and goes forward into presencing from that which is not presencing is poiesis. Poiesis is one of the ways of acting for human beings as opposed to praxis more associated with ethics and episteme more associated with, or Sophia more associated with scientific knowledge. It is a bringing forth, a production, but also a poetry. And it is linked to the word techne, where technology comes from, which doesn't mean so much production as more an art, a skill, and a craftsmanship. And in this coming into presencing of a being through the act of poiesis, the being reveals itself unto us. It faces us with the truth about it, and in that sense, you could say technology is a way of revealing it. Is a way of not just applying human knowledge, but also gaining the human knowledge. It is one of the modes of knowledge contrasted by either wisdom or scientific knowledge. But let's not stick around with the Greeks all too long. In the last 2,000 years towards modernity, we see a shift in understanding of causality. As I just explained, the ancient Greeks had this element of teleology in it, this intrinsic end embedded in all the substances around us. This was completely rejected by Bacon throughout the Middle Ages. It already lost in popularity. At the beginning of the Scientific Revolution, it was completely negated. Then came Hume, who really clearly here in his first definition of causality explains it as one object in front of the other. Later on, he makes things a lot more complicated. We won't go in there now. And then further through towards modernity, you see Laplace, who explains the world around us as objects facing natural law, laws of nature. Which brings us to this shift in understanding of causality is quite exemplary for how we regard the world around us. Which brings us to modern technology, which is very much linked to modern science as opposed to how it used to be. What we see nowadays is that due to its immense complexity, technology requires science, but science also requires the tools of technology to be able to receive empirical data about the world around us. The two become very strongly interlinked, and they share methods and practices of objectification and the use of formal logic in the sense that they use empirical data and apply mathematics towards that to explain and try to pre-calculate the world around us. And everything that does not fall into that paradigm becomes a matter of suspension. Yeah, becomes a matter on which it can only suspend judgment. It can't really say anything. There's a lot of human sensibilities and values that completely fall out of this mode of thinking because you simply kind of objectify things like feelings. Some have tried, arguably, but meh. And what is important here is that the quest for science is no longer the metaphysical question of what is the world around us, but is rather replaced by the functional question of how does it function, how can we use it. So this brings us to the notion of Heidegger, which he called Enframing, in Deutsch Gestell. I tried to illustrate it here with the metaphor of a circle. If you imagine the circle as being and the application of mathematics to empirical data as little squares in how we can understand being, then we see here how we have an approach towards being that builds a frame around it but never really quite gets it. And you need to take quite a few steps before you can even see that this is somewhat resembles a circle and you'd be able to roll it around, whereas a more intuitive approach would maybe not get you all that nice data about the circle, but you could just immediately start rolling it around. What it implies is that we have, in understanding the world only in scientific and technological terms, we lose our touch with being as such. And moreover, this is what Marcuse calls the technological a priori, and it comes quite close to what Heidegger calls the standing reserve. We map being onto the plane of instrumentality. That is, the only way we can understand the world around us is in terms of its utility. It becomes, technology becomes the production of a means to an end for the sole sake of utility. This, to see how this functions within the society that we are in nowadays, this is the logical or the epistemological foundation for the technological apparatus. The network of power and knowledge relations that is at play within our society. And it is important to realize that this network is made of people like us, by me included. I work in as an engineer in my day job. I'm sure probably 80-90% of this audience will as well. Maybe subconscious to the individual, but a utilitarian understanding of technology and the methods that follow from it embody as a logic of control and domination, because we can only understand the world around us in terms of utility as far as we concern ourselves with technology. This from that follows a method of trying to control things. And that has its tendency to spin out of control into domination, into what we see now with the buildup of the whole surveillance state. It is often said that because of its objective nature, this apparatus is neutral. In theory, one might argue that science in and of itself is purely a matter of theory and therefore is amoral. It does not concern itself with values. However, the moment you start applying that science, it materializes, it gains a set of agency, and it enters the realm of praxis. The practical, which is the realm concerned that ethics concerns itself with. It is impossible for technology to be amoral. It might be agnostic towards different ideologies, because in his logic it has no understanding of human values, but it is definitely aimed at control and domination. It does not care whether it controls in the name of Iran, the Iran state, or the US state, but it is aimed at control just for the sake of it. The thing now is, how can we intervene into this apparatus? As I said before, it's basically made up out of people like you and me and the objects we create. It's understanding... For its understanding, it used to need, for a large degree, humans to actually do all the calculative work. But as we've come to the last 50 years into the era of digital technologies, that whole aspect of humanities, these armies of accountants and bean counters, have been replaced by a somewhat smaller army of computer scientists. And digital technology has become the physical and technological realization of what used to be an aspect of the mind, which narrows down our space for intervention within the apparatus to the construction of algorithms, really. It is the only logic that it is able to understand. Speaking of digital technology, it might be seen that this term Turing machine is a deterministic logical framework. So if we look back at and framing and all this problematics that come with it, you'd be tempted to think, but only what is calculable in advance counts as being, but since it's deterministic, everything is pre-calculable in advance, so there is no problem, really. That is making the mistake that deterministic does not mean it is predictable. To pre-calculate all the possible states of a Turing machine, you would need an infinite amount of Turing machines. It doesn't quite work. And it is the aim of computer science, in that sense, to control the unpredictable nature of the Turing machine. Thereby, it again hides us from the true being of the computer, or or a Turing machine. And it follows the same logic of control and domination that is prevalent throughout the whole technological apparatus. So now that we've established that and said a bit about technology, we should probably have a look at hacking and how it is different. I would say hacking is irrational. In the eyes of a computer scientist or the regular computer scientist, what we often do is just plain mad, really. One of the most exemplary things about it, that is the obsession with bugs. The bug is an interesting thing, because within computer science, everyone wants to fix bugs all the time. They're not meant to be there, they're not what we pre-calculated was this thing was supposed to do. Get rid of it. This is this forcing being into how we have pre-planned and pre-calculated it. But bugs reveal the nature of the machines that we work with, and they bring forth previously hidden potential. Obviously in exploits, in a buffer overflow that could either segfault, or if you're a bit playful with it, it can do very interesting things. But it can also be simpler than that. In a sense, you could say that, for instance, most of my knowledge about commands for VI came from, at some point, accidentally typing in the wrong key and finding out, oh, fuck, that actually does something. And that could be seen as the VI and is being revealing itself to me through a fuck up and telling me something about its nature. It is very different from the instrumental approach of I want VI to do this, and therefore I read the manual and says what I need to do to accomplish this task. So you could say that hacking comes a lot closer to the poiesis, as the ancient Greeks found it. It is a matter of bringing forth rather than challenging forth. And this poetic aspect becomes quite literally when we see another funny thing that hackers do, which is writing poetry. This is a very literal example, the haiku by from Larry Wall, which kind of kicked off the Pearl Poetry mania. But it doesn't have to be quite this literal. This is beautiful. This is... Well. And for us to be able to appreciate that as such and to find aesthetics in code, in formal logic, really, it's supposed to be really dull and utilitarian, but suddenly it became a playful thing. It is actually functional, but it's not made just to be functional. It's made to be something special, something unique, something explorative. I think that further re-emphasizes the aspect of poiesis that we see in hacking. Because quite frankly, I think if you'd ask Keith Winsino or Mark Horowitz why they did that, you'd probably get an answer like this. Which is quite obviously either a lack of or a false consciousness about what their actual motivation were. But it makes it quite clear that it was not just for the sole sake of utility. It is not... it has a sense of ambiguity to it that comes with exploring the unknown rather than bending it to your will. It's okay if weird things happen here because I'm exploring instead of trying to force something into doing what I just told it to do. But this poetic aspect of hacking gives it the potential to, and at the same time the fact that it speaks in the language of computer code, of formal logic, gives it the potential to be a space for intervention, to place human sensibilities into the technological apparatus. But it's not quite an instant recipe for our liberation or the revolution. There is a lot of dialectics at work in the sense that every hack that comes into being can subsequently be objectified, that is, if you're exploring something and you find something and you subsequently publish an exploit about it, it then ceases to be hacking, really, the further application of this exploit. It's just a standard tool that you use to accomplish a task. There's nothing creative about it, really. In that sense, it's... you say hacking takes place in the ever-shifting margins of technological development. As new technologies come out, we get new things to play with and new things to be curious about. But everything that we reveal throughout hacking then either ends up somewhere in a bug tracker and is fixed, fixed. Or it becomes a standard practice, which might even be worse. we see that, for instance, at universities nowadays that offer courses on computer security and exploitation techniques, which used to be our realm of play and is now, yeah, a standard practice, a standard utility. Yeah, warfare even is rather ugly. So this space for intervention that we have is continuously slipping away for us. We have our little hackerspaces at the moment, but they are in an ever-shifting margin of where we have the room to adjust the apparatus. That kind of brings me to the conclusions for today. It actually fits in the time, I'm impressed. That is not enough for us to be creative and have our little fun with technology within our own hackerspaces. But if we want to make a difference towards the technological apparatus, we have to challenge also the engineering practices in our daily jobs. We have to broaden the space for intervention so that we can actually make a difference instead of remaining locked up in a margin, ready to be once again objectified or commodified in a capitalist setting. It really means we have to be disruptive and not just curious and creative. And why? Well, because we are in the unique position of actually doing so. That's it.
Actually, we have time for questions.
Pardon? Yeah, actually, we've got time for roughly one question. Since all the people present here, I'll ask the internet first. No questions from the internet? Any questions from the room at this time? Okay, if you have, yeah, go ahead.
It's just, I want to question you on something you've implied, that technology and techne is the cause of the violent urge and the urge to control. But I would say every organism, from an ant colony or a virus or whatever, exhibits that behavior. And it's not us, it's not the technology that's put the violence into us, it's built into us. And actually, it's the technology that's made us more peaceable. We have become more peaceable people the more technology we have. It keeps us off the streets.
You mean the irony of having nuclear warheads
we can use the technology to create more destruction, but your likelihood of being killed by violence today is vastly orders of magnitude lower than your likelihood of being killed by violence in a hunter-gatherer technology. Perhaps, if you look at the work Steven Pinker's doing, he's demonstrated this.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's technology in and of itself that causes this spin out of control into control. That sounds a bit weird. But as I said, I think it's very much linked to the epistemological and methodologies behind our current engineering practices and scientific methods, which understand the world only in terms of utility.
But so does a tiger or an ant colony. They're like, can I eat that? Is that a threat to me? Can I stand under that and it'll protect me from the rain? Everything views the world in terms of utility. We may be unique, but we don't.
You already started a very lively discussion. Unfortunately, you cannot continue it on this stage, but I invite you to join his workshop. Thank you for your talk.
Cheers.